Senate and the Judiciary, page 4852, agenda, Tuesday, May 29, 1979, work session, 10 a.m., room 346, House Bill 2109, 2805, Senate Bill 2, House Bill 2011, Senate Bill 778, House Bill 2179, Senate Bill 581, 519, House Bill 2137, 2755, 2017, House Bill 2199.
Jim just advised me that Senator Kulongoski's subcommittee of one dealing with Senate Bill 744, which is a guardianship bill, whether or not, and that Senator Kulongoski has recommended that after we have it re-engrossed. So I suggest that we, if there's a motion, Senator Kulongoski moves that we have Senator 744 re-engrossed. Is there any objection to that? There are none. It's so ordered. Five present, five positive votes for it. Okay?
I will be there.
Let's go to 2109.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. 2109 is a bill submitted by the Governor's Commission on Women. In the form in which it came to us from the House, it amends an existing statute dealing with civil arrest, ORS 29.520. That statute currently is sex discriminatory, reference only male persons shall not be arrested except, and then it has a specific exception, no female shall be arrested in any action except for injury to person, character, or property. And the bill was to delete those sex references because they're unconstitutional. And during our hearing on this bill, Senator Kapoor made a motion to delete all the civil arrest statutes in their entirety. In your folders, I've got copies for the committee of those civil arrest statutes. I might point out to the committee that these statutes were carried into the new ORS when we made the 1953 revision. There has been not a single amendment to any of these statutes in the period since 1953. As far as I'm aware, they're not currently being used and may, in fact, even be unconstitutional as they currently provide. Yes, I did. I got your memorandum from the scene. They currently provide that a creditor can go in and appear before a county clerk and not before a judge. They can go before a clerk, get the clerk to issue a writ of arrest by submitting an affidavit based only on information and belief. And the person better can be arrested and incarcerated for that.
I would hesitate to, I personally hesitate to make any wholesale changes without a whole lot more study than we've done. Just because we haven't heard anything doesn't mean that nothing has been happening. Mm-hmm. We just may not have been in the arena where it was happening.
The whole idea of people arrested is that we're talking to me, I think we're talking to better certain American Americans got went out a long, long time ago, and yet here we have a census. Better certain provisions. They put in jail, first one you hold, you don't pay your debt. But some of it sounds like
Without trial, some of it sounds like
17th century.
Well, it isn't that, let's see. Very civil arrest lies, no male person shall be arrested. We're changing that.
Well, we're just going to change it to
delete
references to male, yeah, and female.
In an action for recovery of money or damages on a case arising out of the contract when the defendant is not a resident of the state or is about to remove therefrom, or when the action is for injury to a person or character, or for injuring or wrongfully taking the taking of the living property.
But that's just going on somebody's affidavit.
And it's on a cause of action and not on a judgment. This is pre-judgment body attachment. Attachment of a person's body, pre-judgment.
Yes.
the cost of the bill originally, in addition to cleaning up the land, had what subsidy contribution made?
It eliminates the possible unconstitutional provision that applies certain laws to males and certain females.
You can get a person, you can hold a male in certain circumstances, but you can't settle now. You can't hold a female on the civil rights.
So,
and I'm suggesting that we don't make that.
Have you run it through the computerized thing, Diana, so we know, do you have all statutes relating to?
All the civil arrest statutes are contained right there in chapter 29. However, you're right, I would have to run it through OLIS to pull out any possible cross-references that might exist to some of these statutes in other areas of the ORS.
Mr. Chairman, just a kind of a modest sort of comment. With all the problems that people have, death and robbery and trying to pay their bills and trying to have their children leave 2 hours in the school, it seems to me that the Governor's Commission on Women is trying on something more constructive to do to improve the world and save this world.
Just doing this without giving anyone an opportunity to be heard.
You have to go back to your house again for.
Well, what I'm suggesting, if you really want to consider repealing the civil arrest completely, we might have amendments prepared and then reinvest it and then set it for another hearing.
That'd be fine.
Okay, Senator Kapori moves that in substance we amend this bill, repealing all sections and references relating to civil arrest. And that the bill be referred to the desk with the request to be reengaged. And the understanding of all this is that after that's done, time allowing, that we'll have a hearing on it.
We won't get a medal for repealing about 10 statutes or so.
I don't get a fine for more or less. Okay, is there a. That's the motion. Is there any objection to that amendment? Hearing none, so ordered. Kirk will call the roll, I guess, on sending it out to the desk.
Brown?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye.
Kapori?
Aye.
Wise?
Aye.
Cook?
Aye. Motion carries.
You've got me a little confused.
All right, we're going to amend it, and I'll look at the amendments, and if anyone else wants to, you're welcome to. That's the proposed amendment to this bill. And then it'll be sent to the desk to reengage. When we get it back, and we'll see how our schedule is, and we'll set it for another bill.
Okay, I'm going to understand now. Yeah, I wonder if there'd be some quick way to get feedback from the county on that little anybody who's been arrested. Thank you very much.
Do we have a correction agency representative here? Or have a bar? Bob, would you make sure you know what? Were you listening?
No, I'm just
asking. We amended House Bill 2109. It will be amended to repeal completely the provisions for civil arrest. And send it to the desk to be reengaged. And would you also, the other people that I think of that might be interested in this, the correction agencies, would you also notify their representatives, our representatives? And we've got you here from the legal aid, you know about it. And so as soon as it's being built, they'll set it for another.
I've got a paper here earlier.
I think we can afford to do it with this one, because even if it's still the eyes, I know no one will really know the
issue. This suggests that both Bill, Mr. Chairman, accomplish the same purpose as passing the law abolishing the entire
chapter. Okay, now let's,
The only way you can get an order under 23777 is if there is an arrearage that is accrued. If there's no arrearage, you don't get the wages holding order. Now, I grant you that there are going to be some situations where a wage is going to accrue because of, you know, accident or disability to the wage earner. So generally, to allow this amendment is going to affect the effectiveness of the wage withholding statute. I realize it was a hardship, but what about the obligee and the children who are the beneficiaries of the court order? What has it been like for them for all those months that they received absolutely no public or no child support when they should have in fact been receiving child support under the child support order?
Well, also, Larry, in fact, you will have every one of these questions before the court, because every one of them will create a hardship.
I practically think that anytime you put a 25% wage withholding garnishment on, you're going to have an argument that it's causing an extreme hardship. Yes. And it's the same garnishment. You can garnish the wages one shot at a time under the other garnishment statute. And, you know, there's no defense to that. If necessary, I suppose court and person divisions go into a real order mill where they get an order on each individual paycheck. The idea of the wage withholding provision in 23777 was to allow a continuous method for the enforcement of child support obligations. And once the arrearage is paid in full, then it drops down to whatever the original child support obligation was.
I think what we probably better do, Jim, is to contact Gene Kurop and tell him find a time. If you'd like to appear before us and explain this position further, preferably on a Monday, so we'll make time for him to do it. But otherwise, it doesn't look like anything is likely to happen on it. But maybe he can persuade us, contrary to present status. Okay, let's move on.
Council 2805, as written, or the Anglo 2805, modifies the procedures by which a petitioner who has obtained a temporary restraining order in a domestic violence situation modifies the proceedings by which the petitioner files that PRO with the law enforcement agency for first enforcement. 2805 proposed that it be filed with the law enforcement agency within the county in which the order was issued, and that law enforcement agency would then enter the order into the law enforcement data system, the LED system, and that the, by virtue of being entered into LED, the order would be enforceable statewide. An amendment made in the House said that a true copy of proof of service on the respondent and a true copy of the order would be submitted to the law enforcement agency. And that's fine, and that makes it much more efficient. However, ORS 133.310, which is not amended by this bill, which is the arrest statute, which mandates that an officer shall arrest when there exists the PRO, makes references to a certified copy being on file, and it's pointed out that this might be used by the law enforcement community to avoid their responsibility to arrest.
You have some many questions?
Yes, if they're in your book, and or in your folder, I'm sorry, the amendment to the Anglo Council 2805. All we're going to do is add section 2 to amend 133.310, change the word certified to the word true, so the 2805 will conform as to that amendment.
Bring objection to Senator Pecora's amendment. Certainly, and so others. Senator Pecora, you still go to court?
Yes, and there was a further amendment proposed to the bill yesterday and I promise I'd bring it to the attention of the committee. It was pointed out that by requiring the petition to be filed with a law enforcement agency within the county in which it's being issued, you'd run into a problem of if an order is issued in Multnomah County, but the respondent is, say, in Klamath County, you must first serve the respondent, and you must attach a true copy of proof of service on the respondent at the time you file your order. But if you have to serve the respondent in a distant county, you cannot file your order until you get that proof of service back to Multnomah County, either drive it back to Multnomah County or mail it back to Multnomah County. And it felt that this would cause some...
What was your suggestion?
Well, the suggested amendment was that the order be filed with any office of the state police in the state, since the state police system, the MUD system, is the system that's going to be used for all of these orders. Rather than going to any small law enforcement agency within the county, to go directly to a state police office in the county. Every county in the state has a state police office, if I'm not mistaken.
Where would that amendment take place?
Well, it would be on line 8 of the Angels Bill. We would delete the boldface language on line 8 and say a law enforcement agency within the county in which the order was issued. We would substitute any office of the state police. And the same amendment would appear on line 10 where it makes reference to the law enforcement agency, reference to the state police.
Have we talked to the state police of having administrative problems on that? Do we have anyone here from state police?
Yes, we do. Mr. Moon?
I'm not prepared to address that.
You're not familiar with any problems with having a CO filed in with the state police for entry into lead?
How long are you administratively set up to handle it?
Would a law enforcement agency or a sheriff of a county enter an order into LEDS under the current version of the bill?
Can you tell, under the bill as drafted, how will it be handled administratively and mechanically?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm Lloyd Smith, manager of the LEDS system in the executive department. Each law enforcement agency, or most law enforcement agencies in the state, have a LEDS terminal, and they would enter the restraining order just like they would enter a warrant entry or a stolen vehicle entry. In fact, they can enter restraining orders into the system currently.
Take the paper itself filed.
The current law just says with any law enforcement agency, in other words, the people file where they keep the current law allows them to file a restraining order with, quote, an appropriate law enforcement agency, unquote.
The bill here would do what? Something different?
The bill here, initially, the bill would have required filing with the sheriff of each county to eliminate some of the duplication of filing. That has been changed to read a law enforcement agency within the county. The proposed amendment would make that the state police.
What's your thinking on the proposed amendment?
In terms of administration, we've got no great policy issues. In terms of administrative practicality, it would depend entirely on the administrative policies of the Oregon State Police. The Oregon State Police outlying stations currently implement some records directly into the system by their policies. There are some records that they must communicate to their headquarters here in Salem for entry. So the practicality of that would depend entirely upon whether the state police wanted to assume and accept that responsibility.
Why couldn't, under the present language, we have a law enforcement agency within the county
And isn't the state police a law enforcement agency within the county?
Yes, that would be covered there. That's correct. However, that state police office would have to be in that county in which the order was issued. So you still have the problem of the respondent being served in a different county, but you can't file your TRO till you get back to the county in which the order was issued. Okay. There may be some significant time delay there in getting your order online.
Right.
Well, Mr. Chairman, beyond that, there will be filing problems because the state police do not cover this case. There are other police officers that do cover this case, and the state police do not.
I'm not sure what you mean by it.
There are communities that do not have state police in them.
That's correct. There are large areas that are only served by one state police office.
That's right. That's what I'm getting at.
I know I'm no executive commission. I have another concern, and I'm trying to think back from my years of practice. The attorney, theoretically, is going to be the person who certifies this thing to be a true copy when delivering it to the law enforcement agency for filing. Now, if service takes place, let's say, down in Klamath Falls, that paper is going to have to come back with evidence of the service before the attorney can certify it to be a true copy and deliver it to the law enforcement agency. So I don't see what good it's going to do. In other words, it's not going to expedite the filing by saying that the state police can receive it down in Klamath Falls unless the attorney drives down in the car, looks at the service, certifies it to be a true copy and delivers it. Any way you look at it, you've got a time lapse problem.
I know that we have House Bill 3131 here now, and that's the Code of Civil Procedure. We considered, we spent weeks, months on it, and it was introduced in the House, passed apparently without any objection or concern. Is that right, Bob? And no point raised, you know about this?
There were two votes against it, Mr. Chairman, in the House.
But in the committee, nothing raised. I suggest we send it out. There's no point in harping on it. Senator Smith moves that we send House Bill 3131 to the floor. Be fast. Clerk will call the roll.
Brown?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye.
Tofoi?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Wyatt?
Aye.
Cook?
Aye. Motion carries. Okay.
Do you have anybody
in mind? I'll carry that one. We've had so many hearings on 31. We certainly, well, a lot of them required to have any public hearings, and we've over complied with that. Okay, now let's go. And I have the advantage that you can get it out, and the governor can sign it, and it can be printed, and so on. Who was assigned to it last time?
Senator Tofoi.
Why don't we have Senator Tofoi say it again? We said it actually this time. With 2805, the one we just got through passing now.
Was that the marriage bill?
Yeah, that's the marriage bill. It was assigned to him, and then there was some little problem. And that. Senate Bill 2.
Yeah.
Okay, we got that down there.
Mr. Chairman, there are proposed amendments in the report to the Senate Bill 2.
Thanks, Robert.
Did you open up the
can? Oh, did I?
safety option amendment on saying no commercial loan.
Who are?
These are some rather expensive. These amendment batteries. The bill that came out of the inn, and after I read it, you know, this is a good argument why we should keep the print as bold as it was when we first did it. If you read the bill, so that's all I needed to read. But the paragraph 2 relates to the question of criminal offender information. And we had a hearing on the bill, and the amendments that you have in your folder were amendments that were drafted and suggested by the people who testified at that particular time. And if I could, I'll just go through them. And it's on page 2 of Criminal Bill Line 14, release probation.
The Oregon State Police no longer gets information on probation.
Mr. Chairman, if you just like to read this one at a time, just to work out like this, I would read the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, a motion has been made, and what's the reason?
The Oregon State Police do not get the probation information. They don't have it.
And what's why is that? Why do you need to amend the law because of that?
Well, it says that they're supposed to give out that type of information, and they don't have it.
Is there any objection to amending the bill, deleting the word probation on page 2? Line 14. No objection is so ordered. Okay.
Okay. On page 3, Mr. Chairman, line 2. Diane, I'm trying to remember why the Oregon State Police wanted.
All right. I can answer that. What we would effectively be deleting is that reference to court-appointed or retained defense counsel on line 3 and 4, because right now, in order to have computer access to the Oregon State Police computerized criminal history files, you must execute
he's on
an
agreement.
Pardon?
Okay. He said on page 3, line 2.
Line 3 and 4. The Oregon State Police could not execute the required agreement with every private defense attorney in the state. It's just not a practical matter. So what we propose to do is just allow them to execute agreements with district attorney's offices, which is the current law, city attorneys who have criminal prosecutive functions, those are organized offices, and public defender offices within the state of Oregon. There's only 4 of those.
The first time person can get this new year back to Canada.
That's right. And there's no way for the Oregon State Police to execute the required agreements with every private defense attorney in the state. And agreements are necessary before access can be had.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that the Oregon State Police Amendment, which would on page 3, line 2, ask the district attorney.
What we're talking about is the alternative amendment on page 3, line 3, delete, and court appointed, and then delete line 4.
I suppose that amendment, Chairman. So it would read, Sub B would now read district attorney, comma, city attorney for criminal prosecutor, constant comma, public defender's offices.
Or public defender offices
in the state of Oregon. Period. It should be comma, not period. I propose that amendment, Chairman.
Okay, we've heard the proposed amendment. Is there any objection to that amendment? Hearing none, it is so ordered.
Mr. Chairman, the rest of it is basically that the rest of this amendment here that you have, specifically the rest of page 1, page 2, page 3, all the way down to line 24, all have to do with the next amendment. And I will explain to you what it is that if you look at page 3, line 8 of the delete of the printed bill, a deleted section is any other state or local agency designated by order of the government. That is deleted. The problem that has come up is that, as an example, at the University of Oregon, or the State System of Higher Education in the security division on the campuses, are constantly in contact, I understand, with the state police and these people when they have certain problems on the campus. And they have to be able to get this type of information. And what the reason it was deleted, I would tell you, is that in the interim we found out that there was the criminal records council was sitting trying to go through every single agency in the state that requested it to our board of commission and determine if they needed a authorization to gain this information.
And there were no standards and criteria to guide them in
the decision. And so what we did, what we found out there, was just all basically was an argument, and they kept applying if you refused, you applied again, and tenacity paid off. And what we did is we just decided to eliminate that, but it's obvious that we had to put a new section in attempting to regulate this type of approval, and what we've come up with is what appears beginning on line 19.
And you're not proposing that you restore that language?
No, I'm going to propose that a new section be inserted and not really put in the new language, because the amendment that I'm proposing, basically what it does is it gives the governor's office guidelines on the granting of which state or local agency is entitled to receive this information for the students as a criminal justice agency. And that's what that is, as I said, beginning on line 19, the rest of that page 2, and page 3 down to line 24, all have to do with the creation of that section. The reason, Diane, you probably would better is to explain to why the amendment has to be as long as it does.
Well, to set out the which types of state agencies will be considered for access, set out the guidelines for granting it, that the agency may require criminal record information to implement a statute or executive order that expressly refers to criminal conduct, or state or local agencies which have a specific agreement with the criminal justice agency to provide services, and they need the criminal justice information in order to supply services. Individuals or agencies for purposes of research, state or federal agencies authorized by statute to conduct investigations for security clearances, where individuals or agencies where access is authorized by court order. And then the next subsection 2, starting on line 8 of page 2, says what will happen once the governor does authorize access to these criminal records, that says they'll make a specific finding of the duty and function that requires access, and they may impose conditions necessary to preserve security and privacy. They advise the person who has access of what liabilities attach to violations. And then subsection 3. Okay, now the governor may determine whether or not to give full access or access only to a specific identifiable individual on a specific occasion, so that, you know, he has control of the type of access he grants.
Now, you're in section 3?
Subsection 3, line 18.
Sure. I was wondering, is this authorizing the governor to open up those records to anybody?
It's now only to those agencies set out in subsection 1 of this new section, starting at line 19, A, B, C, D, or E. They have to be either a state or local agency that requires it by statute or executive order, or the state or local agency that has a specific agreement with the criminal justice agency. Individuals or agencies research, state or federal agencies conducting security clearances, or individuals or agencies authorized by court order to have access. Those are the only five groups to which the governor can grant access.
So sub 3 A and D refers back to
the type of access.
To section 1.
Right. Either a limited sub-1 access or a general grant of access.
Okay. Senator,
where do these standards come from?
These standards came from House Bill, don't blame, 2579, which was the House Bill in the 1975 session. That these standards did not cause the problem that caused the special session to repeal House Bill 2579.
If I could, the standards, all this attempt to do, as you recall, Bob Oliver said, look, we're caught because other people want this information, the agency. But if you're going to allow them to do it, you've got to tie it down and give it express direction on who shall and who shall not get
jobs. I understand, but I want to know where the standards, who drafted them initially, and what the suggestion here as to include these messages or not all included.
Well, they were from House Bill 2579 in the final version of that bill, which I understand was a compromised version of the bill worked out by the ACLU and the governor's office and various police agencies and agencies that needed access to the criminal records.
Others were having trouble determining who's going to prove out.
Well, all criminal justice agencies that are defined as such by statute under 181.010 will continue to have access. We're not touching that. And those are, law enforcement agencies are, law enforcement agencies, county sheriffs, all municipal police departments, state police, other police officers of this and other states, law enforcement agencies and the federal government, and criminal justice agencies will be the governor, the courts of criminal jurisdiction, the attorney general, district attorney, law enforcement agencies, corrections division, state board of parole. And then we're adding city attorneys with prosecutor functions and public defender offices. So those are by statute, and we're not touching that. What this is to determine when the governor shall grant access to other type agencies that are not. Not the school district, but say the Board of Education, People Transportation Division.
Teachers, families, and training.
What
about school board?
The school board itself? A local school board itself?
No.
I doubt it, because they would go to the people transportation board.
They would go to the district attorney if there was a rumor that a prospective teacher had a criminal background, they would have access.
Yes.
Yeah, that's also handled through the institution.
Some of them on Curtis Mitchell, when the Board of Education had access to this information that they were speaking to the Smith on the grounds of criminal conduct by the teacher after he was certified.
It looks to me like Senator Brown, and the question you're asking, under Section 1, Sub A, is very broad.
It seems like that would cover
about anything.
That would cover the Bureau of Labor on
implementation of the statute, that language is
an employment agency would not have access.
Not in the criminal justice agency, but the rest of this bill.
Maybe you want to get rid of the rest of the bill. Let's deal with this part of the state.
But under the, another provision of the bill, they'll get some limited access to tech employees. That's what the bill is all about, really.
All right. Let's see. What do you think? What's the proposed amendment here?
Yes, I think so. Unless you're questioning.
I agree with you, Mr. Chairman.
The amendment deals with the standards. That's correct, and what else did it deal with? Anything, or is that?
It was just stuff up after the standards are done, the details of the kind of agreement that they have to make.
Secure
security and make sure that down the line, if they go to somebody, it's not going to be disclosing unjustly.
So, is there any objection to the proposed amendment? There are none, so are there. Now what about, these are some pretty extensive changes. Are there any other amendments being proposed?
I think, Mr. Chairman, beginning on page 3, on page 4, line 3, after crimes incurred of the department, and it's a clarification on that, and I was meant to
say that.
Line 25 of the amendment, where it says, it's number 6, it says on page 4, line 3.
Okay, so we've adopted up to there.
Yes, sir.
Right. Now, are you suggesting that?
Yes, that's the clarification amendment proposed by counsel.
Yes.
Page 4, line 3.
That's the clearance and state of the department.
Yeah. Record
building.
It is just ambiguous.
Is there any objection to that proposed amendment? There are none, it's so ordered. Are the rest of these amendments you have here?
Housekeeping.
Housekeeping.
Yeah.
Yes, I believe
page
4,
line, deletion line, page 11.
I agree with the language in subsection 1 there in section 5 is probably superfluous. Scrap out explain basically what Section 5 does in many ways is sort of the meat of the bill. It sets up a new procedure whereby a person, say an employment agency, private employment agency, or an individual who's hiring somebody, may go to the Oregon State Police and may inquire whether or not John Doe has an Oregon criminal record. The department will answer yes or no. If they answer yes, they shall provide the base on which the individual was arrested and a county in which the arrest was made. That will permit the individual making the inquiry to go back to the local level where the full records are open, and they are now open. All criminal records at the local level are now open. But the problem has been for an employer, they, right now they're forced to search the records of all 36 counties, but they can do it if they want to because they are open. And this merely directs, they answer the question, yes or no, does this person have a record? If they do, where you can find the records at the local level.
I suggest to the members of the committee that we delete the rest of the provisions of the bill. What I'm suggesting is the part that would provide, in effect, the dossier to anybody who wants it on anyone's criminal record.
Okay. Well, I do want to clarify, this doesn't provide the substantive information. It does not provide the rap sheet or open the rap sheet.
It tells them who's convicted and it tells them what county and just basically leads them.
Yeah. This says yes, conviction, Multnomah County, Lane County, and the date. And so the person can't have access to the local records without conducting a thorough search of all this.
Yeah. Do you have penalties for improper disclosure?
Improper disclosure by whom?
The custodians of the records.
You mean the Oregon State Police?
Yeah.
Well,
or if they give it to somebody, they give it to the chief of the training package from somebody there.
Well, they're subject, I suppose, to administrative
penalty. But there's no statutory penalty for improper disclosure.
No.
We have talked about that, and that was not put in the task force.
What was the reason, Mr. Chairman, another question, the reason of the task force for these sections that the chairman proposes to delete?
You want to go into this?
Well, I
don't think
the basic policy
function. This has been the battle that has existed since, what, 75? And it's trying to determine how the criminal record information will be controlled. If you start off the two extremes, you've got the one extreme where some people say nothing should be disclosed, and the other extreme is everything should be disclosed. And what we've basically done is fought over trying to find out where that middle ground is, where everybody can basically agree to it. What was finally developed is this process, which is a compromise, basically, with all the entities that were involved in it, on the basis that what we would come up with is a proviso, since there was one place where all this information is public record, and that's in the file, the courthouse. And that's what and the press is the one I think very truthfully has been pushing very hard for, is that if in fact that there would be a procedure instead of being required to have the whole rap sheet, which, you know, it has all the problems with it, it's not up to date, it has erroneous information with it, that they should be allowed to have one spot where they could go to and they could check the accuracy of it and be responsible for the accuracy of it. And that was the decision that was devised through the computer and responding yes or no, Baltimore County, Lane County, and that was the policy that was being made.
I think question one out of the that these records are now available in all 36 counties. Currently.
Every piece of information in the Oregon State Police files now is open at some level of
amendment.
Very
allows one to zero in on which county.
Two counties,
four counties.
Well, I think the issue is why should the state of Oregon serve as an information collector for anyone other than state agencies and those who are affected? Why? They are public records. They are available. They can go down and get them. What we've done is install an extensive system of information retrieval. And I don't see why the state of Oregon should function in maintaining this. You can talk all you want to about how they're going to have to go do it. You're going to give them a list, criminal conduct, yes or no, and where are they? Well, there's not much difference. And I don't see that, and maybe it's not. Maybe members may well disagree. I don't know why we should be providing that information to anybody and everybody who wants it. If they want to go look, let them go look. What's the policy? What are we going to advance? And how can we justify spending this money?
Well,
That's right. I mean,
All the property that he owns, it's all right there.
I mean, it's a difference, it's a big thing, it's closer to 1984. No, it's almost, what this does is determine my opinion is it ensures that this information which is available presently, at least when you're going to get it, it's going to be accurate, and it's a question of whether they're not getting it now, they are getting it, but with the problem is that they're doing it on compiled reports that are highly inaccurate.
Private database.
Well, if they better not publish it, maybe subject to libel. That's what this is.
They might even get tired and not do all of it. Sometimes you make it harder for people to get things they don't get.
So my motion would be we delete that part of the bill, leaving in the cleanup for the agency. Okay.
You want to do that section 5?
Yeah. Okay. Why don't we send the bill off to have it re-engrossed? We got some good extensive amendments there. Yeah, why don't we get the other amendments in? Part of amendments are all. Yeah, we left the amendments that are proposed on 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and 13. Any objection to the adoption of those amendments? Hearing none, it's carried. Now, Senator Kulongoski moves that the bill be sent to the desk to be re-engrossed. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those no, motion carried, it was unanimous. That's what will be done to it. Let's go on to the next bill. House Bill 2011.
Sunshine law.
Is that 818 law?
You don't have to go to it.
Oh, wow. I see. All right, John.
That's a picture.
Yeah.
At our earlier hearing on this bill, Senator Smith, you raised the question of whether we have really thought accurately and adequately about in line 13 of the Senate bill, for the records to be treated other ways and by court order. And it turns out that, again, I was guilty of not coming up to date far enough. You are quite correct. That should be court order or in compliance with statute or. The problem is that I haven't really kept up to date on changes in the law. And in 1957, the statute's word change to authorize a court administrator, in fact, to require a court administrator or a county clerk to actually seal records and adoption.
Will you do that, Senator?
Without having a court order. And some of the judges around the state did remember that. Unfortunately, those records I've seen still don't know if they had a court order sealing them. And that is what we're talking about. It's after 75 years. Adoption records in the record seal by court order or in compliance with statute. This bill would simply remove that restriction and allow them to be used without further restriction after 75 years had passed. And in line 15, after the word person says he is or has been, again, in the case of those who have been in custody at a state institution, to be certain that their records are not openly available within the period of 25 years, the Federal Amendment 916, after the word government in court are exempt from disclosure for a period of 25 years after termination of such custody. The way the current statutes read, it actually is possible for a prisoner released to have immediate access to all of his records from the state penitentiary. Barring considerable argument with the penitentiary and a possible court action. And it does seem more reasonable to keep those records restricted for 25 years after release, since indiscriminate access to them during that period could easily interfere with the successful rehabilitation for which the key of the program has been aimed. And in line 17, the least of that you, that's the same reasoning there. All of the amendments proposed make it a little bit more clear exactly what the bill pertains to, and add a little bit additional restriction to, on access to the records of those who have been in custody of the state institution. The primary purpose of the entire bill is to provide access as quickly as possible to records that are currently restricted by the provisions of the IRS 192-500 and other provisions in the statute. And it seems reasonable that 75 years after a case is closed or a file is closed, that even these highly sensitive records would no longer be sensitive. They would be more available for use in biological research, genealogical research, genetic research, and in history, in general studies of our history, our past, and in particular, in studies analyzing the impact of legislation by permitting longitudinal research over the lifetime of individuals.
And now, so to summarize, with the amendment, this bill would do what?
And with the amendment, the bill will permit access in general to all records after 25 years with four major and critical exceptions. The exceptions being records less than 75 years old which contain information about the physical or mental health or psychiatric care or treatment of a living individual, if the public disclosure thereof would constitute an unreasonable invasion of privacy. And this puts the burden on the party seeking disclosure to present clear and convincing evidence that the public interest requires disclosure, and the public disclosure would not constitute an unreasonable invasion of privacy. So that for that period of 75 years, these personal records very tightly restricted. In section 2, records less than 75 years old, which were sealed by court order or in compliance with statute. That would be keep restricted and prevent access without a specific court order to records of adoption and records of that type that are claimed by order of the court or by a specific statute. And during the 75-year period, access could continue to be gained by a specific court order, but once the 75-year period had passed, there would be no further restriction on access to those records. I doubt that the use is going to be great. On subsection 3, records of a person who is or has been in the custody or under the lawful supervision of a state agency or court, a unit of local government, this bill, as amended, would actually add to the restriction on disclosure to those records. It would extend it for an additional 25-year period after release, and then after that time, no access restrictions on them. Then subsection 4, added in the House Committee to the bill, in general, the following public record exemption disclosure, student records required by state or federal law to be exempt from disclosure, that is added to be certain there'd be no conflict with the federal statute on access to student academic records.
Very important. On sub 3 of section 3, what records that a person in custody presently are public records? I mean,
none during the time they are in custody.
Now, what about we got in trouble before because some people tried to call up and find out if their husband was in jail, and they said they couldn't tell him because that was the public records law had said that's not disclosable?
Yes, House Bill 2579. However, this current language, and that bill was amended on the House side.
Or a unit of local government. Unit of local government could be in the sheriff and the sheriff who maintains the current
BSD. The current statute just says that a person in custody of a state institution, that the records of a person in custody of a state institution are exempt. And these other words, the court unit of local government, were added when this bill was heard on the House side at the request of the Corrections Division, and to tell the truth, Senator, that kind of the bad episode of House Bill 2579 didn't occur to me on the hearing again. That could be a valid reason for going back to the original language of the original bill. Because the intent of 192.500, the restriction there, is to prevent undue access within the field of rehabilitation of a person in custody.
Isn't there a difference between having records open to close and what's concerned on the two parts of the two parties involved are very different. One is somebody's going to know if somebody in jail, which is a whole different issue from I'd like to see Mr. Jones' records, who is now in the county courthouse, in the county jail. And I can see where one way perhaps ought to be open and one ought to be closed. And should we make a distinction there and say that there is certain information which is public records?
Senator, if you could really count on law enforcement agencies reading this accurately, the records of a person in custody under lawful supervision are access to them is restricted to the extent that the disclosure thereof would interfere with the rehabilitation of the person. And I would find it difficult for Sheriff to argue that letting the guy's wife know he's in jail would interfere with the rehabilitation of a prisoner.
No.
But do you have to go to a court to get a determination if the sheriff says, I'm not going to answer one way or the other, I'm not going to tell anybody the name of anybody?
Well, to the court, you know, there is information that needs to be known besides the fact of a relative knowing whether somebody's in jail or not. The person who said it specifically said that. This does not mean that the relative can't get information about the presence or absence of
them. Yeah, maybe that's just nothing in this language shall be considered. Why don't we do this, Steve? Nothing in this language shall be considered to prevent the disclosure of the fact of the custody.
Steve.
Yes.
Okay.
I would certainly hate to create an additional problem of contemporary records, and what I'm looking at is the source of the statute.
Okay. With that amendment added to the ones proposed by Mr. Porter and Senator Sephora, I move that we amend the bill. Is there any objection? Hearing none, it's so ordered.
Is somebody outside?
Senator Sephora moves that the bill be sent to the floor. Do pass as amended. Clerk will call the roll.
But we certainly don't want the possibility of someone being thrown into a mental institution with our own explanation.
Aye. Senator Brown, will you say that? Very good. Put it. Jim, we're down to you. Do you want to do that now?
Might as well. Corson, do you want to come up?
Seven.
And it's Tom Donica around.
Yeah, sure.
Do you have Donica to do on 778?
I'm proposing an amendment to this bill, which is in your folders, pursuant to a letter from Mr. John and
GI.
And this proposed amendment would basically delete the indirect purchaser provisions of this bill, which is section 4.
Wouldn't that gut the bill?
No. What is left is three important provisions.
Before we get into what messages are, I'd like to ask a question about the leasing of this, if I might.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, what is the relationship between federal law and state law in this? If federal law releases that, or you didn't lease it or put it in, does that affect state law in any way?
Yes. There is now pending a federal statutory change, and perhaps Kirkham can speak to this a little more fully. A federal statutory change in the Congress. If that change is made, I think that you could argue that that would be incorporated into our law.
Okay.
Kirkham, do you think that?
Yeah, the argument will be made. It's not necessarily or conclusively incorporated into state law, but
there is a provision.
But if the Congress does pass it, then I think the next session we'd want to come back and conform our law to that.
Okay.
What's left the bill is that it says that basically the consumers under this act will have standing to sue and be in trust on it. It's very arguable that they already have standing, that the case pending in the Supreme Court now has been argued, the decision hasn't been issued yet. A lot of people think it'll probably come out this way anyway. If it doesn't, I would still want to make our law have standing, create standing for consumers under our antitrust law. Regardless, I would be willing to go with that degree of deviation from the federal law.
You're still talking about Section
4? No. This is the definition on lines 9 and 10 of Section 1. Business or property needs include both business and non-business purchases and both business and non-business injuries. That creates consumer standing. The second section of this that's left in this bill is the current Tatiai section, which gives the Attorney General the authority to bring an action on behalf of the citizens when they're injured in their collective sense by price fixing or some other anti-competitive device. I think this bill is a significant bill with the Illinois brick thing deleted. And I think there is merit in avoiding that degree of divergence from the federal act.
Now, Section 4, if adopted, would do what? You're changing it. You would propose.
I would delete Section 4.
And 4 would have done what?
4 would have overruled the Illinois brick decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, which said that indirect purchasers cannot sue the remote seller. You can only sue the person who fixed the prices and then sold to you, your direct seller. So it's a kind of a privity requirement. And it's one of the theories behind the case is that there's a prior case, Hanover Shoe, was at it, John, that said that the guy who passed on, who was the first purchaser, the victim of an overcharge, and then passed that on, that he could recover the entire amount of damages from his first seller. So you're creating the possibility of some duplicate recoveries and that kind of thing. If you allow the people on down the line also to recover against that first seller. This is, if we adopted Section 4, we create a major division from the federal antitrust law.
But now then what would be left is going to recreate or create what rights in Oregon?
Okay. What would be there? Okay. It will clarify. I'm not sure that it will create, because it's arguable that individual consumers already have standing to sue for trouble damages when a shopping center or some other direct seller to them has engaged in the price fixing. This would make it clear that the consumer has standing if that consumer is a victim of an antitrust violation.
immediate vendor.
He would sue the immediate vendor if the immediate vendor had fixed prices or.
Jim only has to the immediate vendor.
Jim? Yeah.
When that suit is made and the immediate vendor has merely passed on a fixed price and he himself is not the culprit, and he wants to initiate an action to protect himself, would there not be a joint suit?
The vendor?
Yeah.
Well, it's the vendor.
The Myron Frank has passed on a fixed price to the customer.
Then could Myron Frank be sued?
Under the Illinois decision,
the consumer could only sue Myron Frank. They could only sue their direct vendor.
Yeah, but Myron Frank is really passed on the
price. And that's the irony, because
Myron Frank is not culpable.
Unless they're committing some independent violation. Isn't that right, Kevin?
If Myron Frank conspired in any way with, for instance, the manufacturer of Levi's jeans, to use a recent example,
yes.
If Myron Frank conspired with the manufacturer, they would be liable to the consumer directly.
But if they really
passed it on, Myron Frank is in the enviable position of being able to sue the manufacturer for the processing and able to retain for its own benefit those overcharges that it recovered, and then pass those same overcharges on to the consumer. Now, if Myron Frank was not culpable in any way, the consumer is not able to make any recovery from Myron Frank.
That insulates the ultimate victim from the primary culprit.
Well, in many cases it does. You can't say it's an absolute rule without it.
Yes,
but in many cases it does.
Yes.
Could the Trailways Graham case, this has been in the past, could the Trailways Company have come to the Attorney General and institute a suit against Graham?
No. You mean under Section 3 of the Act? No, it couldn't have, because the company was not a natural person, was not a citizen of the state. It was a corporation. It was a business entity. And the parent patriae provision in Section 3 allow the Attorney General only to represent natural persons, natural consumers. They specifically exclude partnerships, any sort of business entity.
Mr. Chairman, an individual riding on Trailways line, feeling injured because of unfair competition from Graham, could have.
I'm not sure they could have. I'd have to think about it. Looks like John has an answer. I think that you would have had real problems in having the individual consumers proving their injury. That was a unique situation, which was not a price-fixing sort of violation. It was really a territorial allocation and a monopolization.
Yeah, they lost profit. There wasn't any overcharge passed on there, so I don't see that they would have any damages. The argument could be made by virtue of the
activity between the two bus lines, the consumers were in some way injured. But there are very definite remoteness problems with that sort of a claim. It would not have been viable for the antitrust to bring, for the Attorney General to bring that case.
What kind of additional people will have to be placed in the Attorney General's office?
Absolutely none, because every action which we would bring as a parent action, we're probably bringing right now, just under state enforcement activities. That brings to mind one other comment that I might make. When we had hearings on this before, I think John expressed some concern that this would create an additional burden on the circuit court. And for the same reason, I just don't think it will. If we bring a parent's action, we are going to be bringing it because there's a civil or criminal violation involved as well. And we're already bringing those actions. This is merely a way to effectuate a recovery in an appropriate case for the consumer. And not all cases are appropriate cases. There are relatively few cases, in my opinion, which would justify a parent's sort of action. But in those appropriate cases, it's a very vital tool. The state of California, just to illustrate that too, the state of California passed a parent statute virtually identical to this. It also was patterned after the federal legislation in 1976. And bringing up Levi's again, as a result of some retail price maintenance violations by Levi's Belt Company, the state of California was virtually able to put out its hand and get a check from Levi's to compensate the consumer. And in a meeting in San Francisco, the attorneys from Levi's made very little bones about the fact that they violated the antitrust laws. But their response to the state federal was, what are you going to do about it? You don't have any vehicle by which to effectuate this recovery. California did. It was an appropriate case to get a recovery for consumers, and they were able to do so.
Make the determination whether the case is appropriate or not.
Largely the facts of the case. I mean, obviously, certainly the Attorney General would have to make the determination whether to proceed with the case as a parent case. But a consumer case has to involve, by definition, a commodity that the consumers buy in great quantities. Yeah, that limits the decision in cases right there.
The decision to place the state as the father of us all is the decision made by the Attorney General.
Well, this statute would authorize him to do that. He has certain abilities under common law, and all you're talking about, Senator, I think, is the prosecutorial decision whether it's pursued, you know, pursued
or not.
Yeah.
The choice.
And it would be,
of course, would be the Attorney General.
Right. With my strong recommendation, one way or the other.
So, what you're saying is you're going to decide which cases will go.
The Department of Justice would decide. Just to give you an idea of the scenario, I would make the determination that this looks like an appropriate parent's decision. But I'm not about to file that case without the Attorney General's authorization.
I understand how that works. I'm just trying to pin down the decision-making process as to the question of problems of harassment and other types of concerns that I quote in the back part of the file.
I can give you a response. I can explain it for you if you want.
This has been, this is part of federal law now, and that's the same potential is there. I know of no indication that authority has been abused, no allegation by any group that the federal parent authority has been abused. I think you have a situation where these cases will be brought only in rather clear-cut situations. It's simply not a wise use of prosecutorial time and effort to bring this in a marginal case.
That's absolutely right. That's our entire policy in the antitrust
right now. But we practice is that. Well, I think this is from the harassment standpoint. I don't have any disquiet about that. I think there could be some threats, some arguments on the other side on the Illinois bread problem, but I think this is safely circumscribed within that.
I can't allow your theories about that. I can explain to you what our policy is, and I can assure you that will not happen. But what would happen a year from now, I don't know.
But that's the point. I'm only saying that the judgmental factor is still there. Which view to bring? That should not spring. I have complete confidence in the Attorney General and you. I wasn't trying to. My point was merely that it's a judgment decision made by a human being. Using all the power to stay behind him when he goes. And that's a very heavy
rule. Yeah, but that is not different in kind, though perhaps in degree, from
the standard exercise of prosecutorial discretion, and probably not in degree. When you look at the size of the fines that can be now levied under the federal antitrust law, I think that's the decision you have to make to trust our elected prosecutors with some judgment in that area.
I gave you a 6-page written analysis of 778, and I attached to it some significant comments by some plaintiff lawyers testifying in front of the Senate committee relative to Illinois Brick. And I agree with Senator Gardner that it's appropriate to do. Probably for different reasons, but I would concur with the deletion of Section 4. Now, that leaves Charles Patriot, which is Section 3, and his definition of business or property, which is 1B on line 9 of page 1. And let me address those two issues, but let me just you gotta look at this, I think, Mr. Chairman, in the context of the Bar's Antitrust Committee, which Gene Fowles, I believe, chaired, and Lee Johnson, the Attorney General then, and there was a broad cross-section of defense and plaintiff antitrust lawyers on that. I was on it, but I was probably the least qualified antitrust lawyer of the bunch on it at the time. Our concern was to get a state antitrust act, the Little Sherman Act, which would conform with the federal act. We did that in 1937 when we adopted the Oregon version of the Robinson-Patman Act, and we put right in the Oregon Robinson-Patman statute that the federal decisions would be controlled. No, we didn't. We didn't put in the Robinson-Patman Oregon statute, but that's in the Redmond Ready Grip, a Ready Mix Cement case. But in 646.715 sub 2, that is our state antitrust act, we say the decisions of the federal court in construction of federal law related to the same subject should be persuasive authority in the construction of these state antitrust statutes. And that's because they have such a tremendous breadth, as some of our members know, of experience in pursuing the Sherman Act and the Clayton Act. So, and our court has none. And we have to look somewhere. So the legislature, and Chairman Wells called, put that right in the statute. Now, when I came before you in 77 and talked about some Hart-Rodino amendments to the Clayton Act, which had to do with interrogatories, I took the posture. I didn't like them particularly on behalf of my clients. But I said, if you're going to adopt amendments consistent with the federal law, make it conform to what Congress did, which would be in the spirit of with the 75 legislature and the bars on antitrust committee. You did that. So if you go to Parent Patriae, it's in USCA 15C. If you're going to make a policy judgment to make our state, expand our state law to conform with 50 USDA 15C. And I suggest to you that you have to make two very significant amendments to Section 3. I spoke to these before. The most significant of which is that the Federal Act in 15B, that is 50C, D gives prevailing attorney fees to either side, either the plaintiff or the defense.
That's right. Upon a finding the state attorney general has acted in bad faith, vexatiously, wantonly, or for oppressive reasons.
And it requires mandatory fees for the prevailing plaintiff.
Well, it's the amount of the plaintiff's attorney's fee, if any, shall be determined by the court.
I think Kirkham proposed it without that in it, but I think it's a limited risk situation for the Attorney General, and I agree it would discourage the vexatious.
Well, that's a minute. The other part.
Is that the money to put that in?
Well, there's another one coming up. Oh.
And the other amendment, Mr. Chairman, is in, on page 12. I'm sorry. Page 2, line 12. And this is copied from 15D. And after the word section and before the word damages, there's a very significant omission. And this is so hyper complicated that
this is the sampling provision.
In price fixing cases, the Congress has said that a plaintiff can prove his damages in the aggregate by statistical or sampling methods. So you got price fixing. You can use a statistical or sampling method to assess your damages. There's a limitation. You can only use the statistical sampling aggregation in price fixing cases. And that's real easy to understand why, because you've got a benchmark with prices. If you get into a monopoly sort of a situation, you take the Greyhound case, and I'll speak to that in a minute, but such kind of a benchmark would be used in a Sherman Tree antitrust action against Greyhound, where you could leapfrog over to statistical or sampling. Statistical or sampling with respect to what? Fixing prices is something else. So I say, if you want to follow the spirit of the Bar Committee and the previous legislatures, you should make it conform.
I could incorporate that in my motion for that.
Well, I told the Senate Gardner that I met up with Chairman Thursday. That's one of the dangers of that testimony. That's why it's good to lobby senator.
That's why you're here, John.
I couldn't oppose that portion of the bill and be consistent, and so I want to understand that. Now, let me get the first one. Would you repeat that first amendment that you were reading?
This would allow the court in its discretion to award a prevailing plaintiff in a current patriae action. Allow the court in its discretion to award to a prevailing defendant attorney's fees upon a determination that the attorney general had instituted the suit frivolously in bad faith, and there's some particular language in
there. Okay, well, that's the first amendment. That's the first amendment.
The second proposed amendment, John, too, if I want to move before
okay.
Are we amending section 3 then to add the what? A new subsection allowing?
I'm sorry, I was out of the room for a few minutes.
Okay, what
is the one? The prevailing defendant,
attorney. In any court's discretion, upon a determination by the court that the suit had been instituted in bad faith harassment.
I can read the federal language, it would be helpful.
The present bill provides for the award of plaintiff attorney's fees, and the federal provision, which was deleted for reasons which I can explain, went on to say, and the court may, in its discretion, award a reasonable attorney's fee to a prevailing defendant upon a finding that the state attorney general has acted in bad faith, vexatiously, wantonly, or for oppressive reasons.
That's the amendment.
Okay.
And where is that going?
That could be inserted in the same paragraph that deals with the attorney's fees, and the numbering does not conform to the way to the federal act, so let me just find
it. Remember
what happened when you left on the class action bill.
Is there any objection to that amendment in substance? Hearing none is so ordered. We've adopted that amendment, the attorney's fee amendment. Now on the other amendment, later, what the heck is that now? I just can't seem to remember this thing.
That was the insertion on page 2, line 12, between the statement second and danger claim. That limiting the use of statistical or sampling methods to price fixing cases. It's exactly the same language as is in the federal law, which limits statistical and sampling methods of proving damages to price fixing.
Okay, that's a conceptual motion. Is there any objection going on in that part?
After section, which would read, in which there has been a determination that the defendant has conspired to fix prices.
Inform the job of the federal act, and that was on line 12 after the word section comma. You would insert in which there has been a determination that a defendant agreed to fix prices in violation of OR 646.705.
Can you supply her that? Could you write that amendment to the council and tell her what it's
going to be? I just want to make sure we're getting this thing fairly
accurate. Yeah. All similar written writing.
Yeah. Okay, we've adopted that amendment. Now, Senator Gardner moves to delete section 4. We've got your motion.
I'd like to just make a statement as to why I am in favor of reading that section. On May 8th, the Fair Plan Judiciary Committee voted the corresponding federal bill out of committee, and it's now been considered by the full Senate. In order to get the agreement of enough senators to vote that bill out of committee, it was necessary to make some substantial changes, and I think they're improvements. What they essentially did was adopt a bill which was pending last year. But in light of the fact that the full Senate's considering that bill, and in light of the fact that additional modifications may be made, I think it would be appropriate for us not to jump the gun, but wait to see what they do with it, and then come back next certain and next century.
Okay, is there any objection to that amendment? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Now, Senator Gardner, you want to move the bill out of the floor?
I have one other point that I better make, if I may.
and that relates to the definition, Mr. Chairman, of business or property on line 9 of page 2. And Jim Gardner asked me if I could do that, and I really can't help but, and you know, you're going to do what you have to do. I appreciate that, but let me put it in context. There was a case called Rider, R-E-I-T-E-R, versus Sonatone Corporation, decided by the 8th Circuit on June 19, 1978. That's the case that is presently pending on a writ in front of the United States Supreme Court. This is a class action brought by buyers of hearing aids, and the trial court said that the consumer class could state a cause of action under Clayton Act for antitrust damages. The 8th Circuit reversed the trial court and held that consumers are not injured within Section 4 of the Clayton Act. Now, Section 4 of the Clayton Act says that a person who shall be injured in his business or property by anything forbidden in the antitrust laws may sue, therefore, in the District Court of the United States. Two words of business or property. If you or I are injured by Sonatone, we can file a private action which is 16 of the damages. But because Section 4 of the Clayton Act that uses the word business or property, Supreme Court has up to now, and it's the opposed with the 8th Circuit Clinton, is going to say that a consumer is not himself, who is not himself directly injured, isn't injured within the meaning of the word business or property. Now, there's a lot of examples, and this has tremendous ramifications. A shareholder does not have consumer class standing to file an antitrust action if there's damage to a corporation, which is a shareholder. A lessor does not have consumer class standing to file a federal damage antitrust suit against somebody that does injury to a lessee. A homeowner that is an owner is injured. I'm suggesting to you that if you enter with the definition of business or property which is in the Clayton Act, and with the historical decisions of the United States Supreme Court with regard to who does and who does not have consumer class standing, you're going to open up a Pandora's box. And I know that this probably can take a different point of view. Consistency being the virtue that it is, I would say the least you should do is to wait and see if the Supreme Court upholds the 8th Circuit opinion in the writer's case. You know? Because if they're going to be, if it does, then we're going to have the most wide open consumer class standing interpretation of the Clayton Act of any state in the United States.
The Ryder decision as of what was the date, John?
I don't know.
roughly a year and a half ago, so yeah, so that they don't.
On the off chance that the U.S. Supreme Court should uphold that decision, I would be willing to have our law deviate and give consumers the right to sue a price-fixing seller, provided that is the direct seller to that consumer. If there's any doubt about it, we can look at the thing next session. But I think even if that case goes the other way, which I think is a high improbability, I'd be willing to give consumers the right to sue a price-fixing seller.
So you want to leave the bill where it is?
Yes.
Senator Gordon has moved the bill to the floor of the staff as amended. Clerk will call the roll.
Brown.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Savoy.
Aye.
Kulianski.
Aye.
Smith.
Aye.
Aye.
Cook. Aye. Motion carries. One more bill. Senate Bill 581, which is the cleaned-up 55-mile speed limit bill. It is not standing where we see it. I'd like to move it to the floor and do that as amended. Now let me tell the committee, in case you haven't checked it, what it does and what it doesn't do.
It's the alien version, right.
So what it is, first of all, it would correct that provision of the law upon which Judge Alderson based his finding that the law does not authorize the current 55-mile speed limit. And it corrects that. Jim, why don't you tell the committee how it corrects that? It's quite simple.
It basically eliminates references to the Department of Transportation, which is over the commission. We purchased that with references to the Transportation Commission. So now there is no parceling out of responsibilities under that statutory section. It is all embodied in the Transportation Commission. It's a very minor change, but it will have the effect of eliminating the problems raised by Judge Alderson.
The other thing that the bill does is to clean the language up to make it clear that it is the responsibility of the Oregon Transportation Commission to make a finding as to whether there is a current or imminent fuel shortage. If it makes such a finding, then that triggers the 55-mile speed limit. There's also a provision providing the opportunity for an annual review. Any citizen, the commission itself may review the fact situation, or any citizen can trigger this redetermination. Now, as I understand the birth out state, that's not possible now. It's kind of a catch-22 situation.
Mr. Chairman, look to the national situation to determine whether or not there's energy shortage. And basically comes up with the conclusion that they have to accept the interpretations on a national level, the federal government, because they just don't have the wherewithal to do it. This bill would limit the consideration to whether or not there's imminent or current fuel shortage in the state of Oregon.
That's true. Yes. I suggest you part the transportation has no whether there is or is not a fuel shortage in Oregon, Salem, Portland, Jordan Valley, or anywhere else.
That may be so, but under the present law, they suppose that we make that determination, and this simply would provide a procedure, or since they have that obligation, they would make the final.
Right.
That seems fair, doesn't it?
Why do you want to hold into current or imminent?
Because
there is a shortage in the state. What if there's going to be a fuel shortage in 3 years if we go on burning gas too fast?
I would think that an imminent fuel shortage would be one in the foreseeable future.
Oh, well, if that's That's the intent. It means in the reasonable foreseeable.
Reasonable foreseeable future. I think that's what imminent really means.
I always thought imminent meant you were just about to jump.
Day after tomorrow. No, I don't know what.
I don't think it's wrong, because we've got to do it anyway. And the federal government tomorrow has decided that it's going to be a future. It's not state of origin. And the state of origin.
Well,
they are. All we do is one day in the Sunday, it's going to cost money and doesn't get any help. It's my concern.
And you pulled on that as well.
All right. Let's have a vote. I'm sending it to the floor. This pass is amended. Clerk will call the roll.
Excuse me, Chairman. There's one piece of information that I haven't talked to you about that I've put in the folder, and that is that the Department of Transportation has changed its position on federal level. And that has happened since our public hearing. They are now saying that this would be an overt hostile act on the part of the state.
Not passing this, it would only be if they acted on this. Now, this isn't a repealer.
Okay. They expressly say in the letter that they are making no decision on whether or not the prima facie case, which would be. Violation of the basic rule. If the commission decided that there was no imminent fuel crisis in the state of Oregon, however, even though they passed the buck on that question, they specifically stated that any tampering with the 55 mile an hour ceiling would be considered a hostile act.
Well, that is not a tampering with a 55 mile speed limit. It simply
isn't, Chairman. I'm almost going to do that. There is no specific authority in the regulations for what the council for the Department of Transportation is suggesting. However, the state officials here have informed me that the Department of Transportation on federal level has been stepping outside the bounds of the federal regulations. Without panel. So I just wanted to get that information in front of you so you have full information on this.
Okay. Clerk will call the roll.
Brown.
No.
Garner.
No.
Kapoor.
No.
Kuhnha.
No.
Smith.
No.
Wyatt.
Aye.
Cook.
Let me move it again without recommendation. I asked the committee to move it to be sent to the floor without recommendation.
Brown.
Aye.
Garner.
No.
Kapoor.
No.
Kuhnha.
No.
Smith.
No.
Wyatt.
With all these no's in there now, we want to set out the floor to the recommendation.
Well, aye.
Cook.
Aye. I still don't think we got enough votes.
Two, three,
okay. We're adjourned.
We have a public hearing at 1:00, remember?